This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Ambush at Corellia, Volume 1 of the Corellian Trilogy by Roger McBride Allen. All right, Chewie, try it now. Han Solo stuffed the comlink back in his pocket and stepped back a bit from the Millennium Falcon, an anxious look on his face. It ought to work this time, but that was what they had figured the time before, and the time before that. He could see into the Falcon's cockpit viewports from where he stood, and Chewbacca didn't look all that confident either. He saw Chewbacca reach for the lift controls. Han realized that he'd been holding his breath and forced himself to exhale. The Millennium Falcon shifted slightly on her hard stand, then rose slowly into the evening air. Chewie took her up until the landing pads were at Han's eye level and held her there. Han pulled out the comlink again and spoke into it.
That's good, good. Now engage the shields.
The air all around the Falcon seemed to shimmer a bit and then steadied down. Han stepped back just a bit further, not wishing to be all that close when Chewie cut the repulsors.
All right, Chewie. Repulsors, off.
The glow of the repulsors dimmed, and the ship dropped abruptly and stopped, suspended in midair, with the landing pads waist high off the ground. Sparks and scintillations flared and flickered here and there on the hard stand as the Falcon's shields shifted under stress.
Good, Han said. Very good.
Suddenly, the sparking grew brighter, fiercer, just under the number 2 landing pad.
Chewie! Repulsor's on! It's gonna...
With a shuddering flash of light, the rear shields blew out. The aft landing pad slammed into the hardstand with a bone-rattling impact that sent Han sprawling. The forward end of the ship hung in midair as the rear half bounced on its jacks back up into the air. Chewie brought the Falcon back down to a gentle landing and cut the repulsors. A moment later, the gangway lowered itself, and Chewie came out, carrying a shield-tuning set. That was not good. After all the years Han had spent with Chewie, he knew better than to let a frustrated Wookiee vent his feelings on a repair job.
Maybe that's not such a good idea, Chewie. Leave it for now. Leia's probably waiting dinner on us anyway.
Amazing how times changed. After all the close calls, all the battles, all the captures and rescues and risks and victories Han had been through, now it came down to getting home to dinner. Han Solo looked up into the evening sky of Coruscant. What was it now? 18 years? 18 years since he had hired on to fly a crazy old man named Ben Kenobi and a kid named Luke Skywalker out of Tatooine. Taking on that job had changed his life forever. And changed the course of galactic history, if you wanted to get grandiose about it. It was 9 years since the defeat of Grand Admiral Thrawn and the Dark Jedi Master. 9 years since the birth of the twins, and just over 7 since Anakin was born.
Captain Solo?
A small, slight, dark-skinned human, a woman, stepped out of the shadows by the hangar entrance. She wore a dark blue uniform that might be one of the Republic Navy branches, but Han was not up to date on what the Navy was wearing these days.
Who might you be?
He asked. She came toward him, smiling calmly. He could see her a bit better now. She was young, maybe 25 standard years at most. Her eyes were set a bit wide apart, and they were a trifle glassy. Her gaze seemed to be a bit off-kilter, as if she were almost but not quite cross-eyed. Her jet-black hair was done up in an elaborate braid coiled on top of her head. She walked toward him with an easy confidence.
Glad to meet you. You can call me Kalenda.
All right, I can call you Kalenda. So what? Han said.
So I have a job for you.
That brought Han up short. A job? Kalenda shifted her gaze so she was looking almost but not quite in the direction of Chewbacca.
Perhaps we should talk alone.
I don't want to hear anything you have to say that Chewbacca can't hear.
Very well. But perhaps at least the three of us could talk in private?
Fine, Han said. Come on aboard the Falcon.
The probe droid hovered silently up into position, coming up over the wall of the hardstand area, then dropping behind some packing cases to keep out of sight. It was painted matte black and was all but invisible in the deepening shadows. It watched the two humans and the Wookiee head up into the ship. It extended an audio monitor probe and aimed it at the Millennium Falcon. After a moment's hesitation, it moved in closer to the ship.
Kalenda walked up the ramp and into the ship, Han and Chewie following. She reached the top and walked smoothly and confidently toward the lounge. It took Han a moment or two to recall that she had never been aboard the ship before. She should have stopped at the top of the ramp, uncertain of where to go next.
You know everything about me, down to the blueprints of my ship, Han said. You have resources. That doesn't impress me. I'd like to get home to my wife and family. What is it you wanted to see me about?
Your wife and family, Kalenda replied.
The compartment was silent for a moment, and Kalenda stared hard at Han.
I am not threatening your family, but New Republic intelligence would like to make use of them. And you.
New Republic intelligence? What the devil was NRI doing coming to him? If Han was too well-known a person to do smuggling work, he was definitely too well-known to be much use as a spy. Besides which, he didn't much like government spies, no matter who the government was.
You're not improving your survival odds, Han said. Just how are you going to use us?
We know you're going to Corellia.
Oh, you must have a crack team of researchers that checks the news every single day.
Our trip to Corellia is not exactly top secret. If anything, it was what passed for headline news in these quiet times.
Leia was part of the Coruscant delegation to a major trade conference on the planet Corellia. It was supposed to be the first step in reopening the whole Corellian sector. The sector, Han's home world, had always been an inward-looking part of the Empire and of the Old Republic before that. By the time Han had left, Corellia had gone past inward-looking to downright secretive and hermetic. Leia had counted it as a triumph just to get the Corellians to host the conference in the first place.
Your wife's attendance has been reported, yes, Kalenda said, but there has been little or no mention of your going along, or your children.
What is all this about? My wife is going to a conference on my home world, so what? I'm going, and we're taking the kids. Be nice to show them where the old man came from. Is that a crime? Is there something suspicious about that?
No, not yet. But we'd like to make it suspicious. Something's going on in the Corellian sector, something big and something bad. We don't know what. All we do know is that we've sent in a half dozen agents, and none of them has come back. None of them has even managed to report. We want to send in another team, and we want to provide cover for them. That's you. We want you to act as suspiciously as possible. Give yourself a high profile, be visible, draw their attention, while we insert our real teams.
What about my family? Would it be dangerous to take my children to Corellia?
Kalenda sighed. It was as if the NRI agent had suddenly vanished and the person behind was appearing.
I wish to the Dark Suns you hadn't asked me that. I honestly don't know. We simply don't know what's going on out there. If avoiding all risk is your only concern, take your children and hide them away in a cave, just to be sure. But is that the way you want to live?
In his old days, his reckless days, Han wouldn't even have thought twice about flying straight into the worst sort of danger. But fatherhood did things to a fellow. However, risk was a part of life, and you had to take a slice of it along with everything else. There were questions of honor and duty as well. If there was trouble back home, in the sector that had given him birth, what sort of man would he be if he could help and did not?
Thank you, Han said. I always appreciate a straight answer. We'll be going to Corellia, and I'll do what I can to act suspiciously. I have a feeling it'll fit in with my natural talents.
After she was gone, Chewie looked toward Han.
I know, he said. But our agents are vanishing on my turf. Is that my people doing that? Should I just turn my back?
Chewie just grunted and turned back toward the cockpit. He didn't have an answer for that one. Han followed behind him to help him power down the ship. But the Wookiee stopped dead just inside the entrance to the cockpit, and Han nearly walked up his back.
Hey, what are you...
Chewie gestured for silence with a wave of his left hand as he stared straight ahead out the cockpit's viewport. Han saw nothing, but that told him as much as he needed to know. A probe droid, or a living snooper. Chewie had spotted some tiny movement or other. The fact that the snooper was still out there could only mean they were hoping to hear more. Han improvised as best he could.
Oh, yeah. With what she was saying, we're going to have a lot to talk about on the way home. Lots of profits in it for us if we play it right.
That ought to be intriguing enough to keep their friends interested. He and Chewie gestured to each other, and keeping their hands from prying eyes, outlined a plan. Han walked down the gangway, whistling tunelessly to himself. He wandered over toward the port side of the ship as if he was about to head around and look at the aft landing pad. He continued his leisurely walk toward the rear of the ship, and then suddenly shifted direction, started running straight toward the packing cases, moving as fast as he could, blaster at the ready. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see the Falcon's ventral laser cannon pop out of its recess and blaze away. The cases blew apart under the withering fire, lighting up the hard stand. And suddenly, in the flashing strobe-like bursts, it was bright enough for Han to see the thing he was chasing. A probe droid. An old-style Imperial probot, floating in midair not 10 meters from him, its 8 cool-looking sensor arms hanging down from its rounded central body. One of its arms swung around, aiming a built-in blaster dead at Han. Han returned fire and, thanks either to luck or marksmanship, shot the blaster off the droid. But the loss of its blaster didn't even slow the droid down. It brought another arm to bear, one with a cruel, needle-sharp end, and moved toward Han at speed. Han dove for the ground, and the needle arm spiked into the permacrete and jammed there for a moment. Han fired up at the droid, but it must have been luck on the first shot, because this time he missed completely. He squeezed the trigger again, and nothing happened. The holdout blaster's tiny energy cell had been depleted with only 2 shots. The droid pulled its needle arm up out of the permacrete and then turned back toward Han, ready to move in for the kill. A single shot from the Falcon's laser cannon flared out and caught the droid square in the body. The ghastly thing crashed to the ground, and Han started breathing again. Chewie came running down a moment later, carrying a glow rod.
I can see that. 20 years old at least. Someone dug it up from somewhere and reprogrammed it. The way the Imperials programmed the things, they weren't supposed to fight, they were supposed to spy. If they got caught and couldn't run, they transmitted their data on a tight beam and self-destructed.
Someone out there was playing for keeps. What the game was, or who the players were, Han had not the slightest idea. But it had to be Corellia. It had to be. Jaina Solo squatted down next to her younger brother and handed him one of the circuit boards.
Come on, Anakin. You can figure it out. You can make it work.
Anakin Solo, all of 7.5 years old, sat on the floor of the playroom surrounded by broken bits of droid and worn-looking circuit units. Jason, Jaina's twin brother, had done most of the scavenging, digging through the discard bins of all the droid repair shops and parts suppliers. Jaina had done most of the mechanical assembly work, but now it was up to Anakin. All 3 of them were good with their hands, gifted in mechanical things, but Anakin went beyond merely being gifted. He could fix things so they worked, even if he didn't know what they did or what they were. It was almost as if he could see inside machines. Outsiders would have thought it all very remarkable and perhaps even impossible, but the twins were used to it. To them, all it meant was that Anakin could tap into a different aspect of the Force than most people. In the past, the twins had set Anakin to open foolproof locks for them, make security cameras shut down at the right moment so no one would catch them, power up lift tubes that were supposed to be inert, and generally come in most handy in the service of his older siblings. Now they were going to have their own secret droid. Anakin opened the access panel on the broken droid and plugged in the actuator. He closed the door and looked expectantly at his older brother and sister.
Done? Jaina asked.
Done, Anakin agreed. Jason stepped forward to the droid, reached out to push the power button from as far away as he could, and then stepped hurriedly back. The droid shuddered awake, rattling a bit as it did so. It pulled its wheels in, lit its panel lights, and made a triple beep.
Good morning, young mistress and masters. How may I serve you?
Well, one word wrong, but so what? Jason grinned and clapped his hands. Good day, droid. First, tidy up this room.
Certainly, young mister.
The droid rolled toward a bit of junk on the floor. It extended a work arm to pick it up, and then stopped dead.
Oh, dear. I seem to have thrown. I am afraid I am going...
The droid started rocking back and forth on its wheels.
Uh-oh,
Anakin said, scrambling to his feet. Suddenly, the droid's overhead access door blew off, and there was a flash of light inside. A thin plume of smoke drifted out of the droid's interior. The panel lights flared again, and then the work arm sagged downward. The droid's body, softened by heat, sagged in on itself and drooped to the floor. The floor under the droid darkened a bit, and the ceiling turned black. The twins looked at the droid and then at each other.
We're dead, Jason announced, surveying the wreckage.
Maybe we can blame it on Anakin, Jaina said. We could tell him he did it.
Their little brother looked up at the two of them, a little bit worried, a tiny bit startled, yet still a lot calmer than he should have been under the circumstances.
No, Jason said. We can't tell them. If they knew the kind of stuff Anakin can do, that would spoil everything.
So far as Jason and Jaina were concerned, they and them meant the grown-ups, the opposing team.
Yeah, Jaina agreed reluctantly. I guess you're right. But how do we explain a melted droid?
I'd sure like to hear you try, someone said from behind them.
There were very few people who could enter a room without the twins realizing it, and only one of that number was likely to be anywhere near the Imperial Palace.
Hello, Uncle Luke, Jason said.
Luke Skywalker, Jedi Knight and Master, hero of 100 battles and 1,000 worlds, champion of justice, loved, revered, and feared throughout the New Republic, surveyed the damage.
Pretty impressive. So, what did happen?
We wanted our own droid, Jaina said. One we could use without bothering the grown-ups.
And without getting the grown-ups to give you permission, Luke said. So, you tell me, why aren't you allowed to use droids for most things?
Because we have to learn to do things on our own, because we shouldn't rely on them to do our work for us, Jaina recited.
But there's more to it than that. You're not going to live your whole life on Coruscant. There's a whole galaxy out there, and most of it doesn't care much about people who can't take care of themselves. You're not always going to have droids around to pick up after you.
But you have R2-D2, Jason protested. He follows you around nearly all the time.
He helps me pilot my ship and do data access and do other real jobs that he was designed for. R2 helps me do my work so I can do it better. He doesn't do it for me or help me get out of doing it.
Luke nodded at the melted hulk in the center of the room.
Back before you repaired him so well, do you really think that droid there was designed to do homework for sneaky children?
Well, no. Sneaky? Anakin said. Not me. I'm not sneaky.
Luke smiled.
No, you aren't, and I want to make sure your brother and sister don't make you that way.
They got you to help them do this, didn't they?
Help? I did it, mostly. They helped me.
Luke frowned thoughtfully at that, and Jason held his breath. If any grown-up were going to figure out just what Anakin could do, it would be Uncle Luke. This was far from the first incident concerning Anakin's abilities. But Uncle Luke laughed, and it was plain from the look on his face that he couldn't quite imagine 7.5-year-old Anakin Solo assembling a droid.
Farnes Gleesri, agent of the Human League, sat in his hidden bunker deep in the bowels of Coruscant and checked his detectors one more time. He came up with nothing once again. The probe droid had vanished utterly. Farnes fretted to himself, knowing just how costly and difficult it could be to get probe droids, even obsolete ones. That was part of the fortunes of war, but he could not imagine the hidden leader would be exactly pleased to learn the droid had vanished. But still, the droid's task had been secondary. The real task, of delivering the message to Skywalker, was yet to come. If he delivered the message too soon, Leia Organa Solo could elude the trap. If he delivered it too late, all of the hidden leader's other plans might well fall apart. In deep space, far from any inhabited system, a small solitary star hung in the firmament. It had no name, but only a code number, a string of digits to identify it on the celestial charts. Star number TD10036EM1271 had no planets to speak of, only a few debris belts that had never coalesced into worlds of any size. It had no resources that were not available someplace else, and was not of any particular aesthetic or scientific importance. In short, there was no good reason for anyone to bother with it, and no one did. Any astrophysicist worth his or her or its salt would have been able to make several very basic measurements of that star and report back immediately on its age, the course of its development, and the pattern of its future evolution. And all of the astrophysicists would have been wrong. Many light years away, hidden deep in the Corellian system, a secret team of technicians and researchers was seeing to that. They had been working for a long time, but soon their efforts would bear fruit. Soon, the energies of their machines would reach across the stars. Soon, they would change everything. Luke drew himself up and took a deep breath before he pressed the door annunciator at Mon Mothma's quarters. He had learned to respect many beings in the galaxy over the years, but Mon Mothma held a special place in his esteem. It was she who had pressed and prodded the Rebel Alliance into being. More than any other single person, she had created the New Republic itself. The door slid silently open. Mon Mothma nodded to him and smiled.
"Greetings, Jedi Master."
Mon Mothma's quarters resembled the woman herself, quiet, unassuming, yet with an air of steady confidence. There was little furniture, but every piece was finely crafted, graceful yet sturdy, in muted shades of ivory and white.
"I am pleased you could come and visit me, Jedi Master," Mon Mothma said.
She took a seat opposite Luke and looked at him with an appraising eye.
"Tell me of your current circumstances, Jedi Master."
Luke was taken aback by the question. Then he realized it was no question at all, but a command. She was the former chief of state. She had access to all sorts of information, and had always followed Luke's career with particular interest. "Well, ma'am, as you know, the Jedi Academy is now well established. I still visit it occasionally, but the students are progressing, and the first class has reached the point where they should be learning on their own. And indeed, some now spend as much time teaching the second and third class as they do learning."
"So you are not needed there?"
"Not full time, no."
"No grand crusades, no desperate battles or heroic missions?"
"No, nothing like that."
"Of course not. We're at peace."
"That's the problem with peace.
No crisis, no trouble,
no adventure. Which means there's not much need for people who are good at dealing with crisis and trouble. But what could compare with what we have done in the past, you and I?" "I don't know," Luke said. "It sounds like you might have some ideas, though."
"Well, it does strike me that another member of your family has faced the same problem.
She has made the same transition from war to peace, and she did rather well for herself." "But it's different for Leia. She was doing the same sort of diplomatic and political work she's doing now, even before the war."
Mon Mothma smiled. "Leia is good at her work, probably better at it than I was. But tell me, what sort of a Jedi is Leia?"
"She has the innate skills, the inborn talent, that much is obvious. But there has always been some other demand on her time that prevented her from pursuing a course of dedicated instruction."
"Yet both of you have always regretted that she has not developed her skills more."
"Well, yes."
"Do you find it upsetting that your sister has great gifts and has not developed them?"
"Yes. Yes, I do."
"Then, Luke Skywalker, I suggest you consider the fact that some mirrors reflect both ways."
"I don't understand."
"It is long past time to reflect on the fact that you have talents and potential you have never developed. If Leia has potential in the Force because you, her brother, have shown you do, does it not follow that you have potential in other areas because Leia, your sister, has shown she does? She has become a leader, a stateswoman, a politician, a spouse and a parent. She is building the New Republic even as she is raising a new generation of Jedi. Let us look in the mirror again. The Republic is in need of a new generation of political leadership. I don't know whether you realize it or not, but it is all but inevitable that you will enter politics, whether you like it or not.
But I'm a Jedi Knight, a Jedi Master. I can't go into politics. And I'm not interested in power.
Mon Mothma smiled again. Let me put it another way. Someone, I don't know who or when or why, will come to you seeking not a leader but a champion. Someone who will ask you to take up their cause, speak on their behalf, fight for their rights. You are not interested in power, but could you resist a call for help?
No, Luke said, something half regretful in his voice. No, if someone put it that way, of course I'd have to say yes.
Be ready for such a chance when it comes, Luke Skywalker. Be not just a Jedi, not even just a Jedi Master, but a Jedi leader.
Luke stood up, preparing to take his leave. I will consider your words.
That is all that I hope for. But there is one other matter in which I hope you will indulge an old woman.
And what might that be?
I understand that you are to meet with Lando Calrissian. He is going to ask you to assist in a project of his.
Yes. Luke wondered, not for the first time, where she got her information. That is so, but I do not yet know what the project is.
Ah. Mon Mothma smiled one more time. I thought you might not. It just so happens that I do know what he is up to. It is an unusual sort of project for Lando to undertake, but it does have that grandiose element to it.
And you wish me to talk him out of it?
On the contrary, I would wish you to offer him every assistance. That it is grandiose does not make it ill-advised. No, help your friend. I believe that in doing so, you will do yourself great good as well.
Something slammed Lieutenant Belindi Calenda forward in her restraint harness as she was approaching Corellia, and her freighter shuddered from a massive impact. Calenda lunged for the flight controls. It couldn't be the buffer heat sink blowing already. It had to be... Another hit! That was no internal explosion. Someone was shooting at her. Even before she had completed the thought, she had flipped her freighter into a barrel roll and taken it into a dive straight for the planet. The freighter was small and nondescript, carefully chosen by NRI to fit her profile of a slightly down-on-her-luck trader. She carried a varied cargo from a half-dozen worlds, and the ship's logs had been expertly manipulated to show that she had indeed been to all those places. There was a flare of light off her port bow as the next shot went wide. She punched up a view from the rear external camera on her cabin display and risked a peek at it even as she jinked her freighter sideways to dodge the next shot. A pocket patrol boat, just as she had thought. If anything else had made two hits on this old tub, she wouldn't still be alive. A pocket patrol boat was a very small single-pilot ship that traded high speed for limited firepower. She threw another random turn into her flight path as she rushed for the planet. Could she bluff a run back toward hyperspace? No, they obviously knew everything else about her. They'd have to know her hyperspace motors had been gimmicked. She couldn't enter hyperspace without the whole hyperspace engine blowing up. The freighter lurched suddenly as the number three engine flared and died. Calenda cut power to number three and diverted it to numbers one and two. She cut off all the safeties and overrides, cut the selector to manual, and stabbed the activate button. An uncalibrated, uncalculated jump into hyperspace this near a planet was nothing more than a fancy way to kill herself, but if she stopped long enough to consider that, she would be dead. This was no smooth transition to light speed, but a lurching, horrific crash into hyperspace, as graceful as slamming the ship into a brick wall. It was a while before she had time to look around and figure out where she was, and found that she had finally drawn at least one piece of good luck. There, hanging round and lovely in the firmament, was Corellia, the planet half in daytime and half in night from this angle. In theory, at least, she ought to be able to get down to Corellia from here. For a moment she toyed with the idea of trying for another of the habitable planets in the Corellian system. There were certainly enough of them. Besides Corellia, there was Salonia, Dral, and the double worlds Talus and Tralus,
two planets that orbited about each other. If there was to be a search for her, it would almost certainly take place on Corellia, making it a good place to avoid. But there were strong arguments against that line of reasoning. They probably did think she was dead. Therefore, there probably would not be a search. Besides, a planet was a rather largish place. Even if they were on the lookout for her, she was a trained operative. After all, she ought to be able to stay one step ahead of them. Them. Who was the them in this case? And what were they up to that merited the taking of such risks? One didn't attack New Republic operatives lightly. But no time to worry about such things now. They would only matter if she managed to stay alive. Luke Skywalker threw his black cloak back over one shoulder and stepped from the shadows toward the Millennium Falcon, which sat on her hard stand ready for liftoff. It was a scene of organized chaos, or more accurately, two such scenes mixed up with each other. On the starboard side of the ship, Han was arguing with someone from the Spaceport Safety Inspection Service, apparently about some sort of clearance regulation, while at the same time shouting at Chewbacca, who was crouched down over an access panel on the starboard wing of the hull. On the port side of the ship, Leia Organa Solo, one-time princess, senator, ambassador, and minister of state, and present chief of state to the New Republic, was surrounded by a little knot of governmental types of all sorts and descriptions. Even in as democratic and informal a government as Leia was trying to build, it wasn't possible to let the chief of state escape for her vacation without at least a few stray details and egos to sort out at the last minute. A line of household service droids was rolling straight between the two groups and up the ship's ramp, delivering the last of the luggage aboard the Falcon. Han and Leia's three kids were racing around like wild things, beside themselves with excitement at the start of the big adventure. Luke went over to see if he could help Leia extricate herself from the crowd of people who seemed intent on keeping her on the landing pad, asking just one last question until night had fallen. But he should have listened when Mon Mothma reminded him that he was not the only one of the two siblings with skills the other had not developed. The crowd around her was already melting away, each dignitary and hanger-on leaving with a smile on his, her, or its face, clearly pleased with the results of the conference, each of them plainly feeling that the chief of state had paid special attention to his, her, or its concerns. Leia turned to him and gave him the starburst bright smile that always melted his heart. "Hello, Luke. An exciting day." "That it is," he agreed. "You're finally going to get a look at where he came from," he said, nodding toward Han, who was still shouting at the Wookiee and the ground staff. "Must be hard being married to a mystery man." Luke was only half joking. "I bet you're looking forward to seeing where he got his start."
"Oh, Han's no mystery man. What you see is absolutely what you get. His past is a mystery, yes. He's never said much, and I doubt he ever will. Anyway, I don't think a family tourist trip is going to do much to shed a dazzling light on the hidden corners of his personal history."
"Well, speaking of family," Luke said, "I have a gift I wanted to give you, brother to sister." He pulled a package out of his satchel. It was wrapped in the finest black velvet. It was thin and heavy, about as long as Leia's forearm. There was a silver ribbon tied around the velvet. Leia undid the ribbon, unfolded the velvet, and let out a little gasp of surprise.
But,
"I know you already have a lightsaber, but I never see you carry it."
"It's been a long time since I felt I had the right to carry one." Leia lifted the weapon out of the wrapping. "A long time since I felt remotely close to being a Jedi.
And that's why I'm giving you one. I couldn't think of a clearer way to say, I think you're a Jedi."
"But I should make my weapon for myself," Leia said. "That's one of the tests."
Luke shook his head. "All the traditions say a Jedi is supposed to make his or her own lightsaber as part of the progress toward knighthood, but tradition is all it is, nothing more. There's no hard and fast law. And remember, Obi-Wan Kenobi gave me my first lightsaber, after all. I didn't build it. So take this one. I made it for you."
Leia looked at the lightsaber for a long moment and hefted it once or twice.
"How does it feel?"
"As if it's supposed to be there, in my hand. It's perfect. But I haven't completed the training."
"No, that's where you're wrong. If there is anyone in this galaxy with the right to wear a Jedi's lightsaber, it is Leia Organa Solo, Chief of State of the New Republic. You are Jedi. Your training is complete." Leia tried the heft of the lightsaber again, and then stepped back from Luke a pace or two. She pressed the power stud, and the saber flared into life with a low-throated hum of power. A shaft of glowing ruby red leaped out from the handle. With a flick of her wrist, she whirled the blade through the air. "Try me," she said to Luke, stepping back another pace or two as she brought the saber to bear. Luke stepped back himself and shrugged off his black cloak, letting it fall to the ground. He drew his own lightsaber, keeping his eyes fixed on Leia. Leia's face was a study in concentration and suppressed excitement as she drew her blade back. Luke could understand her reaction. His blood, the blood of their father, Darth Vader, coursed through her veins as well. He deflected her first thrust down and to the left, then parried her second thrust just before it got under his guard. Leia let her blade slide down Luke's, and then pivoted under his guard, freeing her blade to face him from the right. Luke stepped back and swung around to meet her attack. He had intended to go easy on her, but it seemed that he was not going to get the chance. She was too fast, too good. Luke decided to move to the attack. He thrust out his blade with one hand as he advanced toward Leia, but she would have none of it. Leia swung hard at his blade, knocking Luke's lightsaber completely out of his hand. The light blade cut off automatically when Luke's hand was off the grip. The weapon went sailing through the air, landing 15 meters away on the hard stand. Luke looked up at his sister in stunned surprise and caught the wide grin on her face. She raised her blade in salute and then shut off the lightsaber. Luke picked up his own lightsaber. He clipped it to his belt. He stood there and regarded his sister from a new angle. She was a fighter. "You're good," he said. "Very good." Leia grinned. "I've been practicing when I can on the quiet. Even Han doesn't know about it." "Practicing how?" Leia shrugged. "With the lightsaber I already have, which isn't as good as this one, by the way. Against a series of drone opponents, I guess it's done some good." "I'll say," Luke said, massaging his wrist. It still stung a bit from the lightsaber's blow. "Come on, let's see how Han is getting on with the safety people." Han was getting on about as well as could be expected, which was to say not well at all. By now there was a small crowd of spaceport bureaucrats around him, all of them pointing at this regulation or that in their data packs. Luke heard quiet footsteps behind him and turned to see Lando Calrissian coming out onto the landing stage. Lando was, if anything, looking more dapper than ever, in a turquoise cape over a gleaming white tunic, and trousers the same shade as the cape. Lando came up beside him and nodded absently. "Hello, Luke," he muttered as he watched Han and now Leia dealing with the bureaucrats.
Said the chief inspector. Everything seems to be in order here. It would appear that we have nothing more to do than wish you a safe and pleasant journey."
When the inspector had hurried away, Lando shook his head.
"You did it, you old pirate," he said as he stepped forward and shook Han's hand. "I guess that means you lose our little bet."
"Han, you and Lando haven't been betting on the Falcon again," Leia said.
"Nah, nothing that exciting. I just bet Lando dinner that we wouldn't get past the safety inspectors."
"Well, that's all right, then." Leia patted her husband on the arm. "I better go ride herd on the children before they try rewiring the weapons panel." She turned and followed the children into the ship.
"Han, wait a second," Luke said. "It's one thing to risk your own neck in a dicey ship, but you can't take your wife and children along in a ship that the safety people won't pass."
"Take it easy, kid. You think I'd take chances on my children? Or that Leia would let me, even if I wanted to try? I promise you all the safety systems they were worried about are at spec or above. That wasn't the problem."
"Well, I don't get it," Luke said.
"Real simple," Lando said. "According to the official records on file with Coruscant Control, the Falcon is now a nice, normal, light stock freighter. All of the illegal weapon systems and smuggling hardware removed. Except Han never did get around to removing all the handy little modifications and add-ons and military specification sensors and weapons, and it wouldn't be a good thing if the inspectors happened to notice all the things he forgot to remove."
"I've had other things on my mind," Han said, with a deadpan expression that didn't fool anyone.
"Besides, that sort of gear could come in awful handy out there. Peacetime or no peacetime, the Corellian sector can be a tricky piece of space."
At last the moment arrived, and the Falcon's repulsor lifts came to life, glowing with power. Moving with a smooth and perfect grace that seemed out of character for the cantankerous old freighter, the Falcon rose into the air, did a 90-degree turn to port, and lit her main sublight engines to move off into the dusky sky.
"Come on, Luke," said Lando. "You and I have some things to talk about."
Luke and Lando were not the only ones to watch the departure of the Millennium Falcon. Farnes Gleesry, agent of the Human League, watched as well, several kilometers away, on an observation platform. The platform was crowded with tourists who took him for one of their own and paid him no mind. It was far enough away that he was obliged to use macro binoculars to see much of anything. But he could see two tiny figures watching the Falcon vanish, see them turn away and head back inside the spaceport. Farnes was all but certain that the one on the left was Skywalker. The other was definitely Lando Calrissian. Good. Good. Farnes was pleased to get visual confirmation that his target was on planet. With Organa Solo safely on her way, it was time for Skywalker. But Farnes knew that the Millennium Falcon was not the most reliable of craft. Best to give her time to get out of the system. If the Falcon broke down and Organa Solo returned to Coruscant after Farnes had done the Skywalker job, it could prove most embarrassing. No. Give them time to get well away. Tomorrow. He would do the job tomorrow.
So, what is this project you want my help with, Lando? Luke asked as they made their way back from the landing bay.
There was more than a bit of mischief in Lando's expression.
A whole new approach to the way I do business. Or it might be more accurate to call it an investment opportunity. Anyway, I want your help to get it off the ground.
Investment opportunity? Luke thought.
He glanced at his companion. Lando had always been one to go after high-stakes, large-scale projects, but he had never been one to invite his friends to join the wild schemes.
Lando, I don't think I can help you. I really don't have the sort of big-stakes money you're after.
Lando burst out laughing. Is that what you thought I was after? Calrissian's fly-by-night investments as endorsed by Luke Skywalker, hero of the galaxy? No, that's not it. That kind of gall would be beyond even me.
Look, let's wait till we get to my place. We can sit down quietly in private, and I can explain the whole thing. Luke had thought he knew Coruscant fairly well, but Lando led him through a labyrinth of passages and tunnels and lifts and moving walkways Luke had never seen or heard of before. By the time Lando had gotten to the place he wanted, Luke guessed they were at least 100 or 200 meters below ground level, if Coruscant could be said to have a ground level. The planet-wide city of towers and monolithic structures had been built and rebuilt and overbuilt so many times that no one really knew where the original surface was. On they walked through increasingly squalid and dirty underground passages. At last they came to a halt before a huge blast-proof door. Lando punched a combination into a keypad, and the door slid back into the wall with a ponderous rumbling of machinery. They stepped onto a terrace overlooking a huge subterranean cavern, a hollow dome easily a kilometer across. Luke, quite astonished, found himself on a platform that looked down into a complete pocket city of low stone buildings and cool green parks.
"Welcome to Dome Town," Lando said.
Luke leaned over the low wall of the terrace and admired the view.
"Very nice indeed. Not at all what I expected." "Well, our developers kept it quiet. Didn't want just anyone knowing about it. We found this underground chamber. It had been built for space knows what reason, and who knows how old it is. It's not exactly in the poshest neighborhood, but who cares? You can rent a nice big place here for a tenth of what it would cost to get a high-status broom closet on the surface."
"I suppose you were one of the investors in this little project?"
Lando laughed, clapped him on the shoulder, and led him down a low, wide ramp into the dome.
"Suppose away. I decided just for once to put my money into something small and local. Just this once, why not be one of many partners instead of being the whole show myself?"
5 minutes later, they were relaxing in the elegant, if somewhat Spartan, confines of Lando's house.
"You've really accomplished something here," Luke said.
"Yes, I have," Lando said.
He looked around his parlor, obviously seeing beyond the walls to the town he had made.
That is to say, I did a good job here, but then it dawned on me it was time to move on.
Move on to what?
I've figured out how to get deep pockets full of money, and I need your help to do it.
Well then, how do you get deep pockets?
Simplest thing in the universe. You marry them.
There was a moment of dead silence. It wasn't easy to surprise a Jedi Master, but Lando had done it.
You're getting married? Luke asked at last. To whom?
Lando shrugged his shoulders and laughed.
I haven't the faintest idea.
But how can you marry someone you don't know?
I'm not marrying a who, I'm marrying a what. I'm marrying money. What's so strange about that? People have done it since the beginning of time. A rich wife could do me a lot of good, and I could do her a lot of good, too. Make her richer, for one thing.
Luke looked at his old friend and asked a careful question. Where do I come into all this?
Now, that's the tricky part. I'm not altogether unknown in the galaxy. People have heard of me. Unfortunately, sometimes they haven't liked what they've heard. Some of the stories aren't even true, but they're out there just the same. I figure my candidates will know my intentions are honorable if I show up with a Jedi escort.
Luke fought hard to repress a grin.
Wait a second. Just let me understand this. You want me to be your chaperone?
Lando rewarded Luke with one of his most dazzling smiles.
Exactly. Couldn't have put it better myself. With you around, I'll be respectable. They'll know I'm sincere.
Are you sincere? Lando looked surprised again.
About money? Never anything but.
No, about marrying. What about the woman in question?
Lando looked puzzled.
How do you mean, what about her?
Well, you can't just walk up to a woman and say, "Hello, I heard about your large bank account. Let's get married." Why should she want to marry you? And what about love and romance and commitment and children and so on? She'll want to know where you stand on all that sort of thing.
Well, I really am not at all a bad catch.
Lando made a sweeping gesture.
I have this place, not just the house, but Dometown, providing me with a nice little income. I won't need my wife's money to live on. I just use it to invest. I have a lot of experience in managing large projects and dealing with people. I have a pretty fair war record, and let's face it, I do have some connections with the powers that be on Coruscant.
And bringing me along would remind them of all that, Luke said.
Absolutely, Lando said, completely unabashed. You'd make a great sales tool, even if you never said a single word.
I see. Well, who's on your list?
Quite a number of people,
Lando said, sounding like a salesman who wanted to be sure you knew just how impressive his stock was.
I've been working the data banks hard, doing all sorts of searches. I've come up with about 250 candidates.
250?
That's right.
Lando pulled a portable data reader out of the pocket of his blouse.
I certainly don't plan to visit anywhere near that many myself.
So, who's your number one prospect?
A young lady by the name of Tendra Reasoned. She's a minor functionary on Sikoria, one of the outlier worlds in the Corellian sector. She's not the richest on my list, but she's wealthy enough, and her family is the real draw. They have strong contacts throughout the Corellian sector, and those connections could be worth a lot more than cash to the right sort of fellow.
Who else? Luke asked.
Let's see.
Lando consulted the data reader.
There's Condren Forek on Asbrion. She's a little on the young side, but her father's getting on in years.
What's that got to do with it? Luke asked.
Come on, Luke. Think it through. If I'm going to marry an heiress for the money, I've got to consider how long it'll take me to collect.
All right. Who's next on your list?
Well, actually, the first one I plan to visit,
Lando said.
Sort of a long shot, but she's on the way to the Corellian sector, and that's where I want to end up, so I can attend the last half of the trade summit and see what deals are being made. Her name is Caria Versarian, lives on the planet Laria Carlsil, widow of one Chantu Sulk. He was a ship broker who made his money knowing which side to bet on in the war against the Empire, and kept his money by knowing when to change his bets.
But this is all so ruthless. You're just looking for the woman you can make the best use of, as if you were shopping for a good deal on a land speeder.
Well, that's the way it is in lots of cultures. They don't have much interest in true love, just marriages that can stand the test of time. Besides, the lady in question is going to be shopping for the best deal she can get. Well, that's all I'm after. A nice, honest business deal. So, what do you say? Want to come along?
Luke hesitated. He hated to admit it, but he was tempted. He had been kind of cooped up on Coruscant for a while, and he had to confess to a certain curiosity. How the devil would Lando handle himself? It would require more gall than Luke could imagine to wander the galaxy brazenly shopping for a wife. And Mon Mothma had urged Luke to join Lando on his journey.
"How many of them do I have to help you see?" Luke asked, trying to retain the last scraps of his caution. "The first 10 on the list."
3.
8.
4.
"Come on, Luke, for old time's sake. 6.
"Well, 5.
Lando's face split into a wide grin. "Great! Great, that's perfect. So, when can you be ready to go?"
Luke stood up and shrugged vaguely.
"Tomorrow morning, I guess."
Peace and quiet were rare commodities in Leia's family, and they should have been rarer still when the family was cooped up in a small ship, and yet things seemed to be going remarkably well. It was just after dinner on the first night out from Coruscant, with the Falcon due at Corellia in 2 days. Chewie was sitting at the table with his tools spread out, tinkering with some broken bit of machinery. Anakin was watching with rapt attention, offering his own advice now and again. The twins were sprawled out on the floor, both of them reading. Han was at the auxiliary control station at the aft end of the lounge, doing some sort of check on the Falcon's systems. Leia was seated at the far end of the table from Chewbacca and Anakin. In theory, she too was reading, giving herself the rare treat of curling up with a good book. Instead, she found herself basking in the moment of family, all safe, all well, and all happy to be together.
"What's it like, Daddy?" Jaina asked, looking up from her book.
"What's what like, Princess?" Han asked, turning around in his swivel seat.
"Corellia, what's it like?"
Jaina climbed up into her father's lap. Jason stayed where he was, sitting cross-legged on the floor, but Anakin took his cue from Jaina. He hopped down from where he was sitting next to Chewie and climbed up into his mother's lap. Han put on his best storytelling voice.
"It's a beautiful place. The Corellian sector is made up of a couple of dozen star systems, but the most important one in the sector is the Corellian star system. The central star of that system is called Corell. And the most important planet in the Corellian star system, in the Corellian sector, is Corellia. And the capital city is Coronet. Now, one of the most interesting things about the Corellian star system is that it has so many inhabited planets. It's rare for a star to have even one planet that people can live on. The Corellian system has 5 habitable planets, the 5 brothers, we call them."
"But why are there 5 habitable planets?" Jason asked.
"Good question," Han said. "The planets' orbits are so close to each other that some of the scientists think the whole star system is artificial. They think somebody built it a long, long time ago."
"Wow," said Jason. "Somebody built a whole star system?"
"Well, that's one idea. But if the 5 brothers were put in their current orbits on purpose, it must have happened in the dimmest mists of time, even before the dawn of the Old Republic more than 1,000 generations ago. The next thing you need to know is that there are more than just humans in the Corellian sector. There are the Salonians and the Drawl, lots of them, and a few of all sorts of other kinds of beings. At least there used to be. All 3 species live in Coronet, and species from 100 other star systems besides. They all come to Coronet to buy and sell and trade. At least they used to. We don't really know what things are like now."
"Why not?" Jaina asked.
"Well, it's tricky," Leia said. "We have a lot of general information about what's going on in Corellia, but it's very hard to get solid detail on a lot of things. Even in the old days, you had to do a lot of guessing if you were studying Corellia," said Han. "It's always been sort of inward-looking, not much worried about the outside. And don't forget that half the galaxy is still recovering from the Imperial Alliance War. Corellia has probably taken its lumps along with everyone else, even if we don't get much of that from the reports we get. So we might find out it's the beautiful, well-run planet we hear about, the kind of place it was when I lived there. Or we might discover it's a hard-scrabble sort of place with lots of problems.
I don't want to go to any place that's all crummy, Jason said.
But it might do you some good if you did, Han said. Your mother and I both feel it'd be good for you to see something of life besides the cushy deal you have on Coruscant. You should see how the other half lives. After all, it's how your parents lived not all that long ago.
Were you guys poor and stuff?
I always was, Han said, and your mother, well, she lost everything she ever had in the war.
That was an understatement, Leia thought. The Empire had destroyed her entire planet for no better reason than to terrify the rest of the galaxy.
Anyway, Han went on, let me tell you about the Drawl and the Salonians. An adult Drawl is about as tall as you are, Jason, but a lot heavier set. They have short brown or black or gray fur, or sometimes red. They look a little like taller, thinner Ewoks with shorter fur, but their heads are completely different, rounder, more intelligent-looking to human eyes, with a bit more pronounced muzzle, and with their ears flat to the head instead of sticking up. They are very dignified, very sensible beings, and they expect to be treated with respect. Is that clear? Han looked around and made sure he got a nod out of all three kids. Good, he went on. I won't have to warn you to take the Salonians seriously, because you'll know to do that 5 seconds after you see one. They are big and strong and quick, the average adult a bit taller than me. Most humans think they are a very refined-looking species. They're bipeds like humans and Drawl, but they have long, slender bodies, and they can go on all fours if they want to. They have sleek, short fur and long, pointed faces with bristly whiskers, and very sharp teeth, and long tails, just right for whapping you if you don't behave. They live underground, mostly, and they're very good swimmers. But there's one other thing you should know about them. Chances are the only ones you'll ever see are going to be sterile females. And it's always a sterile female who's the boss. All their males, and all the females who can have children, have to stay at home in the dens all the time.
That doesn't sound very fair, Jaina said.
No, it doesn't, to a human, Han said. Maybe it doesn't even sound that fair to some of the Salonians, but that's the way their society works. Anyway, there are the three main Corellian species. Every now and then a group from one world decides to move to one of the other worlds, so they pack up and off they go. Then the next day, or 1,000 years later, another group on another of the brothers will decide to move, and off they go. Nowadays, all of the worlds are all scrambled up, with all of the species on all of them. Sometimes it's just one kind of people, humans or Salonians or Drawl in one town. Other places, like in Coronet, all three of the species live there. Not only them, but beings from 100 other star systems besides. They all come to Coronet to buy and sell and trade.
Han hesitated a moment, and a look of sadness came over his face.
At least there used to be that many traders from the outside. Things have changed because of the war.
How did the war make it change? Anakin asked.
Han thought for a moment before he answered. Even before the war really got started, the Navy found it harder and harder to keep enough patrol craft out in the space lanes. They kept getting called away to chase this bunch of rebel raiders, or to show the flag in that outpost, or to deal with other crises. The more the Navy wasn't there, the more the raiders and pirates showed up. The more the pirates chased the traders, the less worthwhile it was for the traders to do business. And when the traders went away, the trading went away too, and lots of people in the Corellian sector got poorer and poorer.
And then the war itself came, Leia said, and the Emperor's Corellian government got scared, not just scared of the rebellion, but scared of everyone. They decided the safest thing to do was not to trust anyone at all. They decided they didn't want the traitors. In fact, they didn't want any outsiders, and the Corellian leaders stopped trusting their own people and put more and more of the same sort of restrictions on them. And with the Imperial government propping up the Corellian diktat, that's what they called their chief of state, the diktat could do whatever he wanted without any fear of the people protesting.
But you guys won the war a long time ago, Jason said. Without the Empire, didn't the diktat guy have to quit?
Leia smiled at that. If only the universe were that tidy, that sensible, so that the losers knew when it was time to quit and gave up once it was over.
The diktat never did quit, Leia said. Not in the way you mean. But once there was no more Empire to provide outside support, people started to be less and less afraid. They started doing what they wanted instead of what the rules said they should do.
The more people got away with breaking the rules, the braver they got, and the more rules they broke. The security forces didn't feel brave enough to stop it.